He kōna ipurangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Have you heard the story about the $75 million pizza?
No. What was it topped with? Golden diamonds?
No. It was just a run-of-the-mill Papa John's pizza. But the story behind the pizza symbolizes the crazy last decade in the world of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin.
When I say Bitcoin, you say what? Pizza.
Give me the money. Welcome to 2 Cents Worth. For Newsroom, I'm Nikki Mando.
And for RNZ, I'm Peter Griffin.
When I think of cryptocurrency, I think of Bitcoin.
Well, totally. That's because it was the first. It's definitely the biggest right now. But there are more than 2,000 cryptocurrencies being traded.
Hang on, let's back up. So, cryptocurrencies emerged as an alternative way of paying for stuff.
Yeah, and Bitcoin, like a lot of cryptocurrencies, is really a digital token. It can be transferred or stored in a digital wallet.
It debuted in 2009, the brainchild of a shadowy figure, or possibly a group of people, called Satoshi Nakamoto.
One of the biggest mysteries in the technology world is the identity of Satoshi Nakamoto.
Who is Satoshi Nakamoto?
Satoshi Nakamoto.
Satoshi right. Nakamoto.
Satoshi Nakamoto is a fake name for somebody.
Some people have claimed to be Satoshi Nakamoto, but we have not seen any definitive proof.
And it's almost like Satoshi came and gave us Bitcoin as a present and just kind of left. Okay. Give me the
money. We still don't know who or what Satoshi Nakamoto is, but despite its obscure origins, Bitcoin is now considered as the digital equivalent of gold. It's bought and sold through online exchanges, just like you do with shares, and the price has fluctuated wildly.
It's a pretty ingenious system. It relies on what's called Bitcoin mining. So computers all over the world are put to work on these complex mathematical equations. As the problems are solved, the miners are rewarded with Bitcoin, which are then released into the system.
But there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins.
And are difficult to mine. In fact, the astronomical amount of energy used by all those computers grinding away is now a serious environmental problem. The world literally can't afford it, which is why other cryptocurrencies are emerging that don't rely on mining to produce coins. Since 2009, there have been Bitcoin millionaires made overnight. That's where the dough comes in. Well, the pizza anyway.
I just told people I wanted a pizza and I want to pay with Bitcoin. I didn't want a gift card. I didn't want some weird exchange. I wanted to give you Bitcoin and you give me pizza.
That's Laszlo Hania from Jacksonville, Florida. He was talking to CBS. You'd call him an early adopter. He bought Bitcoin when the technology was very new and the coins were worth next to nothing.
On May the 22nd, 2010, so about a year after Bitcoin's launch, Hania posted his request in an online forum, Pizza for Bitcoin.
You've got to remember, back then, a decade ago, you couldn't buy anything from retailers with Bitcoin. All you could do was literally transfer coins to other Bitcoin users. A student called Jeremy Studevant took Hania up on his offer, accepting the Bitcoin, and in turn using his own cash to order 2 pizzas for Hania.
Hania paid 10,000 Bitcoin, which was around $50.
Now, I hope he enjoyed them, because in today's money, those 10,000 Bitcoins would be worth, wait for it, $150 million.
No.
The price of a single Bitcoin back then was mere pennies. This week, it's around 15,000 New Zealand dollars.
That increase has driven a frenzy of speculation bigger than the dot-com boom and bust.
It spawned thousands of Bitcoin rival so-called altcoins, fueling a whole underground economy.
It's also created an entire industry of companies and entrepreneurs using blockchain. That's the technology underpinning many of those cryptocurrencies.
Yeah, we'll look at that shortly, but first, what's it been like taking that Bitcoin roller coaster investment ride?
And then the value of the coin started going up, and then it dipped back down.
It was actually quite hard to find people willing to speak about this. Some of them are worried about being targeted by hackers, having their coins stolen. Then there are the tax implications. Technically, Bitcoin could be considered an investment. So if you're making a big capital gain when you sell them, well, the IRD will want its share. But I did find Omar Al-Sobki. He's been a Bitcoin investor since 2011.
At the time, it was just fun. It was just a friend of mine got in touch and said, have you heard of this Bitcoin thing? Had no idea. So I went around to his house. He showed me. He sent me some Bitcoin to a wallet. And then we just started throwing money back and forth to each other. That was basically it. And then when we would go out on the town in Auckland City, you know, like someone would buy a round of drinks and then I'll pay him in Bitcoin. And it was just a bit of fun.
A bit of fun. But before long, a decent source of income for Al Sobky too.
My first ever sell was when it went up to 1,180. Then it dipped under that. I sold about 50% of my Bitcoin. So I didn't think it would ever get to that point. So sold then, and then it dropped down to $250 that I brought back it then, and then of course up to 20,000. Sold at 17 on the way down on the other side, 2018, and then purchased back 3,400. So that mentality of playing it in the long term has worked out more. Of course, you can't hit the tops perfectly or the bottoms.
But Al Sobky got it pretty close. So in December 2017, Bitcoin climbed to what is still its peak value, around 28,000 New Zealand dollars per coin. Al Sobky was smart. He got out near enough to the peak. He made a killing.
You can sort of project where you think the trend is going or how we're doing it. But when it comes to those moments of the lows or the highs, it's all emotional for me. And there's a lot of traders that say you should never bring your emotions into it. But for me, it is. It's totally emotional. Because when you're up high, you're in this type, you're in euphoria. You feel it in you. You're racing up. You're like, wow, what's going to happen here? It's going to crash. You're on nerve. Like when we hit 2000, in 2017, when we hit $10,000, I told my very good friend of mine over in Australia that I'm selling all my Bitcoin at $10,000. And then it hit $10,000, but it didn't just hit it. It went to 12, and then it went to 13, and then it got to 20. It got to the point of when we're at the 17, at the 19. I was like, "This is ridiculous," and I just felt it in me, and that's what I sold. And this, especially the first time when I sold in 2014, that was all emotional. I've never seen this amount of money before, because I was what was I 24, 23, 22 years old. And I was like, I've never seen this amount of money before, and I want to go live in Australia. So I just took that as an, you know, just took that opportunity there to sell. And the same when it's dropping down, you can just feel the negative sentiment of the market. You look at your Twitter, you look at all your friends, everyone's getting out of Bitcoin, and that's when you're like, wait a minute, I have to buy here. The fear is at the peak.
It's not all gut instinct for Al Sobky. He studies this closely. By day, he's a blockchain consultant. He's interested in the technology underlying cryptocurrencies and what it can be used for. And even he's had some rough patches.
And I've been scammed multiple times, through exchanges. And back then, you just had to just keep talking to people, seeing what's what. And of course, I lost some Bitcoin in Mt. Gox as well.
Mt. Gox was a Tokyo-based exchange. It was handling about 70% of the world's Bitcoin until 2014, when it was hacked and almost $500 million worth of Bitcoin went missing.
But my major ones back then was Bitstamp.
Bitstamp is a European-focused exchange. It suspended its services in 2015 after a hack. About 19,000 Bitcoins were stolen, but it reopened nearly a week later.
And BTCE, which of course got hacked, got scammed. The guy did a massive run in, I think it was 2017.
BTCE was a US-based exchange, but in 2017 it was shut down and its owner charged with international money laundering, including funds from the hack of Mt. Gox.
My name is Brian Walters, and I'm a crypto investor.
Walters got his start on a trading floor in Chicago. He went on to become a quant.
A what?
Yeah, a quant, or quantitative analyst. He uses mathematical models to make decisions about investments and risk, and he takes a different approach to crypto investing.
So what if Bitcoin was the MySpace and the Facebook came along, as an analogy? And ultimately, you don't know, because you and I could spend all of our day trailing the internet trying to pick that next technology which might be better, but our time is limited and it would be lucky if you did pick that. So my philosophy for buying many was that I could automate it to a certain degree by using a computer to place multiple orders. So I am running, I guess, a very small hedge fund or a very small KiwiSaver fund, a large portfolio, and I'm able to do it because of the way the technology is built.
Walters has literally invested in thousands of different cryptocurrencies, figuring that the next Bitcoin could be among them. And he's automated the process, unlike Al Sobky, who does 4 or 5 manual trades a day.
But like Al Sobky, Walters has made a lot of money. He rode that 2017 boom, cashed out his initial investment, and is now trading on the profits. He's sitting on those coins for the long term.
I've mostly kept it in. I mean, I think that for me, I just say, what am I comfortable of my total net wealth to have in this asset class? And for me, it's around 5%. And, you know, I do a lot of work for, you know, only having 5%. But like many Kiwis, I have way too much exposure to property. Because of its volatility, that's probably a responsible allocation on a risk-adjusted level.
Here's the problem with Bitcoin. It's largely unregulated. And the middlemen or exchanges that facilitate the trading, like Mt. Gox and BTCe, aren't super secure.
What is secure is the currency itself. Each Bitcoin is encrypted with a digital key that can't be altered or tampered with. But it's an anonymous system. A Bitcoin is not tied to a particular person. So if you lose the key, you may never get it back.
If your Bitcoins are with one of the middlemen and their systems get hacked, you could kiss goodbye to your coins.
A Christchurch cryptocurrency trading firm has been searched by police after reporting a breach of its security system. An unauthorised transaction, understood to be in the millions of dollars, has taken place, and police say they're taking the matter very seriously.
That was the Cryptopia hack of January 2019. This was a well-respected Christchurch crypto exchange that had around 1 million users from all over the world. It was allegedly hacked with as much as $24 million worth of cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin, Ethereum, and Litecoin stolen, transferred out of Cryptopia to anonymous digital wallets.
Cryptopia collapsed, it's in liquidation, and the High Court in Christchurch is currently trying to sort out who will receive the substantial remaining Cryptopia assets that have been recovered.
It's a bit of a mess to sort through and could end up setting a legal precedent. Campbell Pentney is a lawyer at Bell Gully.
These assets are a real honeypot to a thief.
He's a specialist in tax law and emerging technologies, including blockchain and cryptocurrency.
Crypto people have a phrase, it's not your key, not your Bitcoin, that applies to all assets. So if you Cryptopia holds your assets as custodian effectively, that means that you, if it goes wrong, you cannot get your coins back unless they allow you to have it. Now, the big issue there that's controversial is in what capacity does Cryptopia actually hold those assets? And this is a fight right now. We have on one hand creditors wanting the money paid right back. On the other hand, 900,000 individual users of the platform who say, hey, money was stolen, but not all of it. That coin of mine wasn't stolen. I want that coin back. Now, the question then is, who does the court give priority to? Well, the investors say, you held that on trust for us. Those are our assets. The other side, the creditors say, no, that's property. Property is not held on trust in this case. Therefore, we're first in line. So you can see when there's a limited pool of assets, it's a real fight to get to the front and make sure you get what you invested.
So cryptocurrency is quite complex. It's technical, it's unregulated, and there are a lot of scammers and hackers in the space. Is it any wonder it hasn't really taken off in the mainstream?
Well, to be fair, it is actually getting easier to use. When I met Pentney, he took me to a cafe in the lobby of Bell Gully's building in Auckland and bought an orange juice with Bitcoin.
So it's $5. I've got $13 of Bitcoin on my wallet. I'm going to show you how to pay with Bitcoin. So I'm going to give you my credit card and hopefully it's going to work. It's waiting. And I think it's through.
Accepted.
Payment successful on my screen. My Bitcoin has gone down. So that was a... Oh, yeah, sure. Orange and mango drink. And my Bitcoin cost was... I think it takes a bit to show up, but that was $5 of Bitcoin. So now I've got $8 of Bitcoin showing on my hot wallet. Thank you.
Thank you.
There we go.
So that was a tiny, tiny sliver of a Bitcoin you just spent.
And that took about 2 seconds to transact.
What's happening there? Is it a crypto FPOS card?
Sort of. It's actually a Visa debit card issued by a company called 10X. It links to a hot wallet on Pentney's phone that holds his Bitcoins. When he swipes his card, his Bitcoin is sold for New Zealand dollars, which is transferred to the retailer.
Somewhere in the world, say in the Philippines, someone has bought $5 of Bitcoin off me to fund that transaction.
And you can buy just a bit of a Bitcoin.
Yeah, so right now you'd need nearly $16,000 to buy a whole Bitcoin. But you can buy and sell smaller denominations, like a tenth of a Bitcoin, that's a decibit, or a thousandth of a Bitcoin, a millibit. You can even buy a hundred millionth of a Bitcoin, and that's called a Satoshi after the founder.
So Campbell probably sold about 300 millionths of a Bitcoin, 300 microbits or 3 Satoshis to buy his orange juice. Apart from the mathematics of it all, that doesn't sound so difficult.
No, it's not really, but cryptocurrency still needs that breakthrough moment for it to be adopted by the average person who just wants to use it to buy things, transfer money overseas and stuff. Last year, it looked like that moment had finally arrived.
Facebook going full crypto, unveiling its new digital currency Libra today, the start of what the social giant calls the Internet of Money to rebuild a reliable and global financial infrastructure.
Finally, the potential to take cryptocurrency mainstream.
Libra initially showed some promise. It was set up as a separate entity to Facebook itself. The Libra Association included Facebook, but also a host of blue chip companies, including the credit card giants Visa and MasterCard, Vodafone and Uber, as well as blockchain companies like Coinbase.
And it's not a true cryptocurrency in the way Bitcoin is. Libra is more like a digital version of the US dollar or the euro. There's a third party, the Libra Association, that controls it and puts up assets to underwrite its value. So there's someone to go to if it all goes pear-shaped.
That should have given it an advantage, but Libra quickly ran into opposition from regulators and from governments. Here's Campbell Pentney again.
I think people were a bit shocked because this came out of nowhere, and I think it dawned upon them the realization at how significant this would be, that you would have a very, very easy means of payment from your bank account into Libra, that Libra would actually be a different currency, a crypto asset backed by a basket of stable coins, so not pegged to any one currency, and that then effectively what you would have is private money issued by a party that in many ways is larger and more powerful than many central banks. And it might start with making payments in Libra, but then suddenly perhaps you can take your mortgage from Libra. So suddenly the entire banking system is moving into a private entity. And when you do that, you take away the government regulatory controls over things like interest rates, which is an important ability to pivot the economy and ensure that the economy is not growing at too slow or fast a rate.
So Libra has effectively gone on hold. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg said,
"My commitment is that we're not going to launch the Libra payment system here or anywhere else around the world until we get the approval from FSOC and the other relevant U.S. financial regulators."
And that might never happen. In the meantime, some countries are poised to launch their own cryptocurrencies.
Venezuela's already done it, right?
Yeah, in 2018, the government there launched the Petro, a state cryptocurrency supposedly backed by the country's oil and gas reserves. The Petro was seen as a way of getting around U.S. sanctions against the Nicolas Maduro government and rescuing the collapsing economy.
But the Petro's proved to be pretty dodgy, plagued by scams, and it doesn't trade in any significant volumes.
China seems a better bet to introduce the world's first functioning national cryptocurrency.
In, I think, September last year, the President Xi made an announcement. He said that China would become a leader in blockchain technology and announced a whole massive wave of projects based around blockchain. And that really set the entire industry on fire at that point. People were quite shocked. And it was no surprise that the central government has now said that they are working on their own digital yuan called the DCEP. It's in a testing phase. It's probably not that far away because China can go pretty quickly when it chooses to. It's not constrained by internal regulations. And I think some have said that that move by China was prompted by Libra and also prompted by Libra having issues and being in a quagmire and having delays in their launch. So China sees itself as able to get to the front of the queue. Following that, we've now had country after country after country announcing similar news. We've had, I think, Australia, Japan, the EU, I think England, Russia, Turkey, many of them, even Iran, all one by one saying that they are working on their own digital currency product. And even now, the Fed in the US are saying they are researching the possibility of a digital dollar.
You'll notice Pentney doesn't mention New Zealand. We're certainly not leading the charge on this. The government has no official plan for introducing a cryptocurrency. But what we are seeing is growing interest here in this blockchain technology.
That's what underpins Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies such as Ethereum, the largest of the altcoins.
Altcoin just means any cryptocurrency that's not Bitcoin.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. There's a lot of lingo to learn when you start investigating cryptocurrencies and blockchain.
Okay, so let's explain blockchain. In the same way that a system of wires and substations and transformers allows electricity to be moved safely to everyone's house in the power network, so the digital records,
called the blocks,
and the links between them,
the chains,
and some cunning coding and decoding to keep the information safe,
cryptography,
means information can be moved securely between a network of computers. So blockchain's like a general ledger tracking internet transactions.
But what makes blockchain different from other networks, electricity or banking or whatever, is there isn't a central organisation, no one sitting at the middle of it that controls the whole thing.
It would be like getting your electricity straight from the power station. And removing the middleman removes costs.
At the moment, blockchain is closely associated with trading cryptocurrencies, but increasingly it promises to change how businesses are organised and even how we own assets. There's also a movement to create organisations totally on the blockchain. They call them DAOs.
DAO stands for Decentralized Autonomous Organizations.
Mark Pascal is a blockchain advisor and former head of the New Zealand Blockchain Association. He sees DAOs as a way to overcome the problems that a lot of businesses run into.
This finally brought a mechanism to allow global, open, transparent communities to actually collaborate and work together towards a common goal. It allowed some of the alternative management practices that have been sort of experimented, these sort of leaderless, very flat structures that traditionally struggled to scale, but had been proven to work in the open source world. Yeah, this DAO concept potentially allowed a new breed of organization that wasn't deeply hierarchical, wasn't sort of driven by a sometimes psychopathic CEO type figure, and could actually build these global communities.
The problem is, if you run a coffee shop, you still have to pay rent and sign a lease, you have employment contracts, a loan from the bank. None of that is blockchain compatible at the moment.
So the DAO has a long way to go to prove itself as a better way to run a business. But Mark is convinced that the concept of the DAO could save us from the excesses of capitalism.
I guess my bigger picture view is that we have to make this happen to save the planet, ultimately, because the sort of the current systems, sort of capitalist systems, which are there to drive shareholder value and protect IP and build up data, are not working. You know, we have this massive problem of the tragedy of the commons.
Everyone's looking out for themselves rather than looking to the greater good.
Yeah, so I think it has to happen. Otherwise, yeah, before it's too late.
So there's a lot going on in this space, but at the moment where the big potential money is in crypto trading, and you really have to have your eyes open.
Every 4 years we have a halving. That is when the supply of Bitcoin gets cut in half.
So this is the next big potential game changer. Every 4 years or so, the number of new coins awarded to Bitcoin miners gets smaller and smaller to ensure its long-term stability. Here's Campbell Pentney again.
And if we keep on doing that, we will run out of Bitcoins by 2140. So a very, very, very long way away. If we get to that point, then what's going to happen is from that point on, the miners will earn their money through transaction fees rather than mining fees. So it just means transaction fees will go up. But of course, that will be a very, very different picture if we're around to see that, which seems very unlikely.
The halving is expected to happen in May and will probably push up the price of Bitcoin, causing the sort of volatility we saw in 2017.
The other thing we'll increasingly see is the rise of what's called DeFi, decentralized finance. We're essentially talking about lending crypto to other people via exchanges or lending platforms. Just as with bank and finance company loans, you can get interest on the value of the crypto you've loaned.
The old idea was that the only way you could really sort of leave the space and be wealthy was to sell everything you have. Now there's a plan B. That is, you could have these assets, lend them out, stake them, and like a share portfolio, you now have a passive income flow coming through you to you regularly.
Still, it's not risk-free. If you lent out your Bitcoin for 1 year at a rate of, say, 5% interest, it may seem like a good return. But what if the price of Bitcoin plunges due to some disaster or recession, say? You have to wait a year to sell your Bitcoin because it's on loan. You've missed the market. Here's how Mark Pascal sees the future of cryptocurrency playing out.
And I think the way it's working through is that we seem to have, in my opinion, we've got these four powerful forces jostling for position currently. We've got sort of the Western democratic countries, we've got China, we've got the mega corporations in this capitalist system, and then we've got this open source crypto community. And in my opinion, really to avoid the sort of emerging likely situations where our financial systems becoming controlled by either China or the Western mega corporations, I believe the crypto communities need to work with the governments more to actually invest and grow these open, transparent global systems that are neither controlled by China or corporations.
And Pascal knows what he's talking about.
Why? What happened?
Well, in 2016, he organized a blockchain conference in Wellington and invited one of the co-founders of Ethereum to speak. Everyone there was expecting Ethereum to be the next big thing, suggesting the price would go much, much higher. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge.
So did you invest?
Well, no. I didn't feel like I understood it well enough. But back then, the price of Ethereum was $10 a coin. If I'd put in $1,000, you know how much that would be worth today?
No, but I'm guessing it's a lot.
$27,000.
Ooh, hindsight is a great thing. I bet the crypto world is littered with those kinds of stories.
The bottom line is that crypto investing isn't for everyone. It's still relatively new, unregulated, and a bit geeky. There are maybe 1,000 people in the world who truly understand this market, and some of them have inside knowledge. Insider trading is a big thing in cryptocurrencies.
So there are a few things to keep in mind, according to our crypto experts. The main one is to figure out what percentage of your net worth you are willing to risk on crypto investing.
Yeah, for Brian, his exposure is 5%, relatively low. You then have to go into investing with your eyes wide open.
That means only dealing with reputable exchanges and ideally ones that have some kind of insurance so you have recourse if there is a hack and your coins are stolen.
Omar says he only deals with the top 3 coin exchanges in the world. Remember, he was burned in crypto scams. He's learned that trust is crucial.
It also pays to look carefully at the transaction fees.
Yeah, they can be significant and vary massively, so do your homework on those. And crucially, brush up on what you need to do to protect your coins if you're going to store them yourself.
Yes, there are 19 million Bitcoin currently in circulation, but 12 million of them haven't been traded in the last year.
Some are in it for the long haul, but who knows how many of those coins are lost forever because the owners lost those private keys or passed away without telling their family where to find them.
You see, at least you didn't do that. Buy in and then lose track of them.
Well, I did buy a few altcoins. They're called Waves. They're all a rage a few years ago, but well, they're worth about half of what they were when I bought them.
Oh, that's terrible. Still, not as gutting as poor old Laszlo Hania, though, with his $75 million pizza.
People ask me, oh man, what an idiot. Why didn't you keep that Bitcoin? And it's like, well, you know, somebody had to start it off.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 2 Cents Worth.
Thanks to Omar, Brian, Mark and Campbell for their insights on all things crypto and blockchain.
2 Cents Worth is available on all the podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts and iHeartRadio. Subscribe and give us a rating. It'll help others find the podcast too.
2 Cents is produced by Liz Garten, audio engineered by Christo Karajov and Mike Robinson and executive produced by Tim Watkin. Next week on 2 Cents Worth, how great would it be if you could get paid every day? Nikki's on the case.